Welcome to Conversations at Mount Vernon's Washington Library. The Fred W. Smith National Library for the Study of George Washington at Mount Vernon serves as the premier resource for all who are interested in the study of George Washington and the Revolutionary and Founding eras. Every year, the library hosts numerous scholars who share our dedication to generate and disseminate new knowledge about all things Washington. The library's founding director, Dr. Douglas Bradburn, has the opportunity to sit down with these scholars to explore their research, and we are so excited to share those conversations with you. Today's guest is Michael Blakeman, a PhD candidate at Yale and the Amanda and Greg Gregory Fellow at the Washington Library for the 2014-2015 academic year. During this lunch and fellowship program, Michael discussed his doctoral dissertation, Speculation Nation, Land and Mania in the Age of the American Revolution. Over the course of the discussion, you'll hear Michael explain how the market for land speculation grew in the 1780s and 90s, while speculators purchased such vast quantities of land, and how land speculators used the American Revolution to boost their sales. And now, Mr. Blakeman and Dr. Bradburn.
Okay. Welcome, everybody. It's good to see so many people here again and some new faces, too, I think. This is our lunch and fellowship program. I am Doug Bradburn, the founding director of the Fred W. Smith National Library for the Study of George Washington, the Washington Library, George Washington's own presidential library. And we're coming up on our two-year anniversary of the opening of this place, and it's really been an exciting 2 years. We've made a major impact, I think, in the academic world as well as in public history, leadership, and education and other areas, and we're really just getting started. But one of the best programs we have is this research fellowship program, which brings different scholars, different ages and different periods in their career here for research and time to work. And I'm particularly always excited when we have these young, rising professionals in the field, because this is such an important way to share what academics do with an interested, educated audience like this one, who are so important to keeping Mount Vernon fulfilling its mission. Now, today we have Michael Blakeman, who is the Amanda and Greg Gregory Family Fellow here at the National Library. He's currently a PhD candidate in early American history at a small college you may have heard of called Yale. He works with Joanne Freeman, who is one of the great stars of the field. Actually, Joanne, for those of you, I guess, who've been around here a while, Joanne served as one of the Gay Gaines lecturers back in the day, long before I was here. Is that right, Stephen McLeod? She was the second one, yeah. So Joanne is an old friend of Mount Vernon, done a lot of work on Hamilton and the duel. Anyway, Joanne was the mentor to two of the fellows we had this year, and Michael is the second of them. Michael got his AB in history from another college you might have heard of, the College of William and Mary, which is exciting for those of us in Virginia. I grew up in Williamsburg, as you all know. And he received his AM and MPhil in history from Yale University. He's taught widely at Yale. He's taught as a graduate advisor. He's been at the Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History as a teaching assistant. He also taught with the Fulbright Commission, the William Fulbright Commission, in the Slovak Republic, in which he taught English there. And I'm going to read the name of this university perfectly, Univerzita Pavla Josefa Safrika in Košice, which is exciting. And he's also the recipient of a number of fellowships, now, of course, this important one at the Washington Library, but also the McNeil Center of Early American History at Penn, the Filson Historical Society in Kentucky, which is a great program, the Gilder Lehrman Fellowship, the New England Regional Consortium Fellowship, and on and on. It's really amazing. His writing has appeared in numerous places, including the Anglican and Episcopal History Journal, the Northern Neck of Virginia Historical Magazine, most importantly in the George Washington Digital Encyclopedia, which is probably the most widely used digital encyclopedia of early American history anywhere. I think this year, actually, we just got 2 million views in this month is our for the encyclopedia. And his most recent article is entitled Martha Bradstreet and the Epithet of Woman, a story of land, libel, litigation, and legitimating unwomanly behavior in the early republic, which should give you a sense that Michael is a lot of fun. He's got a great imagination. He's identified the most crucial thing in getting a job in academia and really becoming a great scholar is identifying a very important historical problem and not one that is kind of an antiquarian. And he's going to talk to you about the work he's been doing, which I think is crucial and significant. So I will let him do that. So please, everybody, give Michael Blakeman a big round of welcome.
Go get him. Hello, everybody. Before I start, let me first thank you all so much for being here today. I work on this project, you know, day and night, and it's really a treat to be able to have such a good, big and engaged group of people to be able to share some of my findings with. So I really appreciate that you're here. I'm going to start off today with a house. It's a big, rambling house. It's kind of an awkward house. It's called the Phelps House. And it sits in the tranquil New England village of Suffield, Connecticut. Now, this Phelps in the late 18th century was owned by a man named Oliver Phelps, who had been a sort of minor merchant before the Revolutionary War. During the war, he served as a deputy commissary supplying the American army. And then in 1788, the year he bought the early part of this house, he partnered with a Massachusetts politician named Nathaniel Gorham, and together they bought 6 million acres of land in western New York, basically everything from Syracuse to the western edge of the state, for $1 million, okay? So Phelps bought this house to kind of reflect his mounting prospects. It sort of announced that he was a man on the rise, and it reflected, I think, more his aspirations at that point than his accomplishments. The New York purchase quickly failed. It went under. But in the meanwhile, Phelps had invested in lands in Virginia, Kentucky, Vermont, Ohio, Georgia. He was speculating all across the new nation. And so to kind of reflect his yet higher prospects then, in 1794, he added a huge new wing to the house, basically doubled the size of the house. And this wing, it included intricate cabinetry and paneling, really fine woodwork, and most impressively, this really incredible wallpaper, which he had imported from the depths of revolutionary France. And he had his workmen paste it onto the entirety of the new wing, both the public and the private rooms of the house. It was really quite a work of art. And you can still go to Suffield, Connecticut and see it. And you walk in and it's just dizzying, these patterns surrounding you everywhere. That's the effect he wanted. That said, you know, although Phelps was making this house really fashionable and at the cutting edge of interior design, his renovations also made it feel kind of lopsided. As you can see in this photo here on the right, the new wing, which is on the right, sits a little bit further back from the old wing. So the house doesn't really fit with the conventional symmetrical standards of the age. People walking by it, I think, would not have mistaken it for a brand new house that was made out of whole cloth. Okay, this was kind of an old thing that Phelps had buffed up and made to be fashionable. Somewhere inside, he hung this portrait of himself, which I'm not sure if you can see it back there, but he's holding a piece of paper, and the piece of paper has his name on it, basically so that you wouldn't forget who he was. You know, he's a new man. He's got to announce his presence. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that this house and the things Phelps furnished it with kind of reeked of new money. Or maybe even new money is a little bit of a stretch, because really Phelps's entire speculative empire, his house, his land purchases, were all built on credit. He had bought a lot of land, but had as yet sold almost none of it. So this house, the furnishings, the land contracts, this seemingly boundless amount of credit he could command, all of them were possible only because it seemed certain that Phelps's land transactions would translate into inestimable amounts of wealth in the very near future. You'll be probably unsurprised to learn that they did not. Within a couple years of having expanded his house, Phelps had to mortgage it. He locked himself inside so that he wouldn't get hauled away to debtor's prison. And then in 1802, he fled to Canandaigua, where he lived out the rest of his days, evading creditors and trying not to get arrested and thrown in debtor's prison. So I think that this mansion then kind of stands as a monument to land mania, an artifact of certain faith in astronomical future success. And that's why I wanted to start with it today. My dissertation project, Speculation Nation, is a business and political history of the nationwide mania for land speculation that swept the early republic in the decades following American independence. And my main questions are, why did this maniacal market in lands develop during the 1780s and 90s? Why did speculators buy so much land? How did they manage to do it? And why did American governments, both state and national governments, decide to sell it to them in such incredible quantities? Now, a word about this phrase, land mania. It's a phrase I use to describe this particularly magnetic market, and it was really magnetic. This is a period when governments are selling tracts numbering in the millions of acres. It seemed like anybody with capital or access was getting involved in the business, and fortunes are being sort of made and then quickly ruined, apparently overnight. It's a market whose reward seemed so certain that it led Phelps to build that incredible house. It also led some people to try and speculate their way out of bankruptcy, even from within the walls of debtor's prison. Okay, so there's something going on here in the way that land is working on these people's minds. I use the phrase mania to kind of frame my study, but it was also a language that people used at the time in the 1780s and 90s to describe the scale and the intensity of this land business. People called land speculation a madness, a rage, a drug. People who got involved in it, quote, suffered the dictates of a deranged mind rather than those of a rational creature. Observing one 4-million-acre purchase, there's a different purchase in the very northern reaches of New York, up near the St. Lawrence River, one land speculator called this 4-million-acre purchase business at such monstrous rate that the very thoughts of it flashes over the mind like extravagant ideas. Another land agent wrote that the mind almost grows wild and is lost in the magnitude of the object and the astonishing accumulation of wealth. George Washington, who, as we all know, was himself a substantial land speculator, was really amazed at how land mania in the 1780s and 90s seemed to numb minds to numbers. So here's one thing he wrote. Men in these times talk with as much facility of 50, 100, and even 500,000 acres as a gentleman formerly would do of 1,000 acres. So that's Washington right there saying, this is a new state of affairs. There's something going on with land right now. This language of mania and wonder implies that speculation was irrational, inexplicable, perhaps even unknowable. But my work insists that we can understand it, and that, in fact, we have to understand it if we really want to understand the outcome of the American Revolution and to get what the early republic was all about. Westward expansion was a fundamental goal of the new nation. It was key to the early American dream, you know, a growing society of independent yeoman farmers and Republican citizens. But expansion was also a problem. When you buy or conquer all this land from Native Americans, you have to figure out how to get it into the hands of ordinary white people, the people at the center of this political economy of yeoman land ownership. And that takes a lot of work. You have to defend the land, you have to survey it into farm-sized parcels, then you have to sell it, you have to finance those sales, you have to get people to go around and collect the payments. It's like an administrative nightmare, and one that these struggling young American governments were really ill-equipped to handle. There was another problem, which was that these young governments were terribly hungry for revenue. The American public, by and large, opposed onerous taxation. So governments sort of decided that selling land was a way to shore up their aching government coffers. That said, the Revolutionary War was followed by a really intense economic depression. So ordinary Americans were not able to buy land at the speed that governments needed to sell it in order to fund themselves. And I argue that that is where land speculators stepped in. Despite really heavy opposition to land speculation, they managed to get governments to sell them millions of acres of land very quickly at rock-bottom prices, and so this land is just flooding onto the marketplace. And the opportunities, therefore, were so good that land became a mania. Now, for the rest of this talk, I'm going to kind of drill down a little bit and share with you some of the ideas that I've been working on during my summer here at Mount Vernon. And I'm going to talk about two main things. The first is about speculators' thinking. Why invest? What did they think they were doing with this land? The second is about their relationships with governments. How did they convince governments to sell them all this land? So first question, why would anybody do a crazy thing like buy 1 million acres of land, especially when governments had shown how hard it was to actually make money off of it? In other words, what gave land so much power as an investment that Oliver Phelps got as carried away as he did? Now, this question takes up a full fifth of my dissertation. By the way, sorry, I should have shown this earlier. This is a map I've drawn up of land mania to demonstrate the scale of everything. The darkly shaded portions indicate purchases of 1 million acres or more between 1787 and 1795. And then the hashed portions are my very rough indication of where land speculation was going on in tracts of smaller scale, you know, hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands, thousands of acres. As you can see, it's everywhere during this period. Okay, so back to this question about what speculators thought they were doing. It takes up a full fifth of my dissertation, but today I want to use just one letter, a letter I found this summer to try and answer a very big question. This letter is by a guy named Abraham Morehouse, who it turns out was something of a character. During the 1780s and 90s, he was bound up in forgery. At one point, he had two wives, so he was involved in bigamy. He also got involved with Aaron Burr at one point, which is rarely a good idea. At some point, he was apparently the victim of an extortion scheme by somebody claiming to be a prophet of God, which is its own fun little story. But in any event, in the 1780s and 90s, this guy is speculating in lands in New York, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, and Kentucky. He's another one of these people whose investments span the whole nation. And then in 1797, there was a really big credit crunch, a transatlantic credit crunch caused in large part by overspeculation in lands. Left and right speculators are landing in debtor's prison and going bankrupt. And Morehouse was afraid he'd be one of them. So afraid, in fact, that he could not take the public stagecoach in and out of Philadelphia for fear of being seen and recognized and arrested. So in the midst of this panic, he writes a letter, which is kind of astounding. He writes a letter to a fellow land speculator looking towards the next great round of land investments. Pardon me. And here's what he said. As the mania of speculation has for some time subsided and cool reason and sound judgment has had time to operate, there he's referring to the credit crunch, painting it in very rosy terms, it must soon point out the great advantages that will arise from selecting such tracts of land as are secure in their titles and good in their quality. The immense population of America must rapidly increase the value of land, and let me add the stability of our government, and in consequence the rise of the American character, must soon encourage immigration, as it must soon be thought an honor instead of a disgrace to be called an American. All these and many other circumstances considered, I should not be surprised to find land take a rise in value, he means, and to see men of judgment appropriate their money in that way once again. Now, this letter contains, I think, three ideas about land in the American future, three sort of keys to unlocking the question of why land mania made sense. And the first one is kind of hard to spot. It's contained in those phrases, secure in their titles and good in their quality. That's a reference to the people who are eventually going to buy this land, settle it, and farm it. You know, the people whose prospects and prosperity will live or die according to the stability of their land ownership and the quality of the soil. In other words, it's a reference to yeoman farmers, Republican citizens, and this ideal of an agrarian republic. Speculators very much bought into this ideal. And that's kind of ironic because the agrarian ideal explicitly contrasted with their own world, the speculators' own world of commercial port cities and investments and kind of financial hocus pocus. But nevertheless, yeoman republicanism is what speculators thought they were selling, and they became real experts at marketing it to a bunch of different audiences. And in the late 18th century, this ideal and the land that undergirded it seemed like a commodity that would really never lack for a market, so it's a sure bet. Idea number two is population theory. Notice all the talk about population and immigration here. Land speculators paid very close attention to an ongoing transatlantic conversation about why populations grow or shrink. Now, this was an era before Malthus. In fact, Malthus's pamphlet on populations, or book, I guess, was published in the exact year that this letter was written, so it hadn't seeped into speculators' mindsets yet. The current wisdom, when Morehouse wrote this letter, was that populations expand to meet but do not exceed available resources. You know, so more space, more territory, more means of subsistence means earlier marriages, more births, more people. And there was also an idea that good governments, governments that foster liberty and mobility and property ownership, kind of facilitate this population growth. People thought they were so linked that evidence of population growth was taken as proof of a good, smart, enlightened government, and vice versa. So there's this kind of mutually reinforcing idea. And in the New Republic, this seemed like a recipe for unprecedented population growth. People predicted that the US population would double every 25, 20, even 15 years. I mean, that's staggering. Imagine if we were looking at that kind of population growth today. For speculators, these predictions mean two things. First, more people who are going to want to buy land in the very near future. And second, rising prices at which speculators could sell it to them. So again, a sure bet. The third idea that I think is contained in this letter is a really striking, exuberant, and ubiquitous idea of American exceptionalism. Here's another example from a couple years before that letter. In contemplating the vast field of the American empire, what a stupendous subject does it afford for speculation? A government which, with its spreading branches, seems in its mighty grasp to promise liberty and protection to one hemisphere. Speculators had real faith in the future power and glory of the American empire. You know, they would point to its republican government, its rule of law, religious freedom, its potential to expand across the entire North American continent. This chatter is all over the place, but I find it really surprising because the 1780s and 90s were actually an era of real uncertainty and instability and fragility in the United States political experiment. You know, the US was weak on the world stage. It was a huge republic attempting an unprecedented federal experiment. There were doubts about whether it could hang together, especially when you take into account mounting partisanship, backcountry rebellions. You know, there were real fears that this republic would splinter apart. Speculators sometimes admitted those fears, but it was the exceptionalism that really operated on their minds and shaped their land schemes. Speculators believed that they were investing in the young nation's certain future greatness. So these three ideas, population theory, yeoman republicanism, and American exceptionalism, are everywhere in speculators' business correspondence, in the booster literature they sent over to Europe. But I was really kind of amazed to find them all in one paragraph here in Morehouse's letter. And what's particularly astounding to me about this is that he's writing this in the depths of a financial panic caused by land speculation. You know, despite all these failures that are going on around him, he still has rock solid faith in these ideas. So that's why I think that they were really key to the logic of land mania. They made land speculation seem like a risk-free investment worth staking an entire fortune upon. So now that we have an understanding of why people would want to invest so deeply in lands, let's talk about how they were able to do so. Why did governments decide to sell speculators' lands in such radical quantities? The truth of the matter is, at first, they really didn't want to. Nearly every government, state and national, with large amounts of land to sell, came out of the gate at American independence trying to craft settler-oriented land policies, policies that would exclude speculation. And the reason why was because speculation in lands seemed kind of parasitical. You know, you're taking up large parts of the public domain, land that had been conquered through the cooperative efforts of ordinary Americans, and funneling it into private benefit. But during the late 1790s, despite this idea, one by one, states and the national government abandon these populist policies and begin selling land in extraordinary quantities to land speculators. And the reasons for that change over time are very complex, far more complex than I'll be able to get into today. But what I do want to do today is convince you that the basic reasons had everything to do with the American Revolution. These were young, fledgling governments, as I've said, with lots of problems that speculators could turn to their advantage. Security needs, their desire to project power westward, tremendous amounts of debt, debt that had been incurred in the process of ushering these governments into existence, the pace of political change and the challenges, the struggle to create and sort out bureaucratic state institutions. Essentially, speculators used this process of revolutionary political change, the challenges and possibilities of creating new governments, to sort of insert themselves into a good position to profit off the expansion of this new republic. So we're going to hop around the country for a couple minutes so that I can show you in a little bit more detail what I mean. We're going to go first to Pennsylvania, then to Ohio, and then we'll end very briefly in Maine. And in each of these places, I'll highlight sort of one particular facet of how speculators convinced governments to sell them land. So first up is Pennsylvania. This is a map of western Pennsylvania. Lake Erie's at the top, and Pittsburgh is right down there near the bottom. Pennsylvania is a good place to demonstrate what I call the great debt for land swap. So as we know, US governments entered the post-war period laden with tremendous amounts of debt. International debt, domestic debt, debt to creditors, to commissaries, to quartermasters, to people whose goods or crops had been requisitioned for the use of the Continental Army, and especially debt to ordinary veterans themselves, many of whom remained in the 1780s partially or entirely unpaid for their wartime service. And Pennsylvania, like a lot of other US governments, came up with a very democratic plan for how to pay some of this debt. The plan went something like this. Take these frontier regions, such as the part of Pennsylvania that this map depicts, regions where during the war, native populations had been terrorized and in some places actively exterminated, and use this now mostly vacant land, bounty land, to pay off the people who had done the fighting. And then once you get these veterans out there on the frontier, they can serve as a kind of buffer colony, you know, to protect the frontier and a spot from which to launch the next phase of westward expansion. Rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat. Pennsylvania issued thousands of certificates to both veteran and civilian creditors to kind of represent these promises. And these certificates, this isn't actually one of them, but it looks a lot like one of them. It's a certificate that represents interest on another certificate. All of these things were made redeemable for small amounts of land in Pennsylvania, you know, farm-sized tracts of land. And this debt for land swap had a couple goals in mind. It was supposed to nurse these new states into fiscal health without levying oppressive taxes. It was, in doing so, supposed to consolidate the independence and the stability of revolutionary governments. And in the meanwhile, it was going to expand the class of yeoman Republican citizens, these agrarian farmers. Now, these wrinkled strips of paper might seem a little bit abstract and ephemeral, but I want to say that each of them kind of contained within it the traces of previous acts, acts that had helped to wrench the colonies out of the British Empire and into political independence. Things like a signature at an enlistment table, a year's worth of footsteps fleeing or chasing British forces, a horse or a blanket or a bushel of wheat sold or seized. So basically, all of these certificates, these debt certificates, represented unfinished social transactions, kind of unfulfilled promises between the state and the citizens. They were IOUs, basically. I like to think of them as kind of the mortgage of independence. But here's the key. These debt certificates did not merely signify those promises. They also made them material. They put them on paper, something that can be sold, traded, inherited, circulated. And indeed, they circulated far and wide for really two reasons. The first was because specie, hard money, coin, was very scarce in the early republic. So these certificates could kind of stand in as a form of money. And as a form of money, they had a market value. And that market value often diverged from the value that was written on the paper itself for a very particular reason, which is that it was unclear whether these new governments, these fragile governments, would ever be able to fulfill the promises that were contained on them. In fact, Pennsylvania issued certificates entitling veterans to these lands here before the government, the state government, was even strong enough to coerce Native nations to relinquish their claim to the territory. All right, so there's a real kind of sticky wicket going on there for the state of Pennsylvania. So this leads to the second reason they circulated, and that's because speculators bought them up by the fistful for far below their face value. Speculators were making kind of a bet that, yes, eventually these governments will be able to fulfill their promises. And if I buy low and redeem high, then I'll actually make a profit on them. In 1785, one writer estimated that there were 20, perhaps indeed 50 soldier certificates in the hands of speculators for every one that remains with the original owner. This kind of speculation in the public debt was not a morally neutral path to profit. In fact, I think it really altered the Revolution's meaning, because buying and selling these debt certificates subtly but significantly changed the social relations, the unfinished transactions that are embedded in them and that they represent. So in other words, swapping out one creditor for another, an ordinary citizen or a veteran for a kind of merchant magnate. In 1785, there was a poem nestled in the corner of a Pennsylvania newspaper that kind of captured the heart of the matter. "Then ask for whom in summer's heat they float." The whom is the veterans. "For whom in summer's heat they flow, for whom they shiver in the winter's snow, for whom, if naked, scout from hill to dale, whilst thirst and hunger cruelly assail. For us," the speculators answer, "sure. For us the soldiers all their toils endure. For us the state shall special statutes frame. Let soldiers and yeomen be content with fame." Despite political outcry like this, the damage was basically done. During the 1780s and 90s, land speculators blanketed Pennsylvania's public lands with debt certificates. So this is a map of that same region of western Pennsylvania. And the portions that are shaded in red represent the holdings that one out of many land companies was able to get by trading in debt certificates that they had bought up for land. It's a tremendous amount of land, and those of you in the back might not be able to see, but it goes all the way down towards near Pittsburgh. So that's one way to get a fledgling government to sell you a bunch of land for cheap. Get your hands on the debt, and then you can kind of command the scene. The second way is to have a really good and timely policy argument. And that takes us to Ohio, the Northwest Territory, and how the Ohio Company convinced Congress to sell them 1.5 million acres of land for $1 million. Now, the Ohio Company was a group of New England veterans, mostly officers, who wanted to speculate in Western lands, and they had been trying to convince Congress for years to sell them land in Ohio. Pardon me, and Congress had not assented. They had kind of kicked the can down the road for quite a long time. The reason why was because Congress preferred a more sort of cautious, settler-friendly policy of what George Washington called gradual seating. And gradual seating means slow expansion, keeping populations compact. And the idea there is that you'll be able to sell lands to settlers at higher prices, and only as those regions become more valuable from the nearby settlement that they're being built kind of right up against. This would allow the government to keep better control over frontier settlements, to create social order. The idea was that it would prevent unchecked privatism. And really, all this aims to try and make Western lands work most and best for the public good. So that's why the Ohio Company had been having such difficulty in the mid-1780s. By the summer of 1787, they're kind of fed up. So they send a lobbyist, not a veteran or a merchant financier, but a kind of unassuming and almost stodgy-looking Massachusetts minister named Manasseh Cutler. And Cutler goes down to New York City, where Congress is meeting, and he begins visiting congressmen, kind of taking walks with them on Broadway, around the Bowling Green, hobnobbing with them at taverns, eating oyster lunches with them. In all these encounters, he deploys a tailor-made argument, an argument that's designed to appeal to the struggling government that these congressmen represent. And the argument is basically, like, give us this land, finally, and we'll build Republican institutions and civil order out there. We'll bring society to the West. We'll create schools and churches and villages, and it'll look actually kind of a lot like New England. And this plan offered a bunch of additional promises. One was that it would extend U.S. control over the Northwest Territory, because that was very contested at the moment. It would bolster security in the region. The Ohio Company promised to handle the surveying themselves, which was important because that cost a lot of money and the government was sick of it. And in the process, this sale would retire the public debt and pour some much-needed money into congressional coffers. These are all things that a cash-strapped government struggling to project its power westward was very excited to hear. That said, Congress still dragged its heels for a while until two key things happened. And these two key things demonstrate that the most important parts of the Ohio Company's argument were the money part and the security part. So the first thing that happened was that another company approached Cutler. This company was led by a guy named William Dewar. It was called the Scioto Company. It was made up of a bunch of New York bankers and merchants and not a few congressmen. And Dewar approaches Cutler and says, look, I got these additional purchasers, and what we can do is sort of join forces and extend the purchase from 1.5 million acres to 5 million acres, and from $1 million to $3.5 million. Now, Dewar and the people he represented did not make any promises like the Ohio Company to actually develop these lands. They just wanted to flip them, preferably to European capitalists for really, really quick money. So they kind of destroyed the whole, in reality, though not in rhetoric, they destroyed the whole set of promises that the Ohio Company was making. By the way, on this map, the Ohio Company's original request is that little triangle that's set in, and then the bit that surrounds it is what the Scioto Company offered to add onto. So suddenly, 5 million acres, that's a lot harder for Congress to walk away from. The purchase becomes much more appealing because a lot more money is going to be coming into the government. The second thing that happened that finally convinced Congress is something that previous accounts of the Ohio Company have missed, and that's that Congress received news literally days before they ended up approving the sale that Mohawk leader Joseph Brant was consolidating a number of Native tribes into a defensive confederacy, an alliance designed to prevent U.S. expansion north and west of the Ohio River. And, you know, different members of these nations had already been raiding parties of American surveyors in Ohio. So this idea of mounting Native power in the West, you know, another power, another confederacy, a lot like the American one that you'll have to contend with, really helped the Ohio Company's cause. To some extent, I think Congress was thinking, holy moly, let's get some battle-hardened veterans out there as soon as possible in case war breaks out. But I'd also argue that Congress was kind of thinking a little bit like a land speculator. They're thinking, like, let's sell this land quickly and make what we can of it before war breaks out and violence causes land values there to plummet. You know, they're kind of trying to get it off their hands pretty quickly. I should add, by the way, that it helped that this was the summer of 1787, and the most experienced statesman, the kind of A-team of national political leadership, was not in Congress in New York City, but was instead in Philadelphia working on a constitution of some sort. So the sort of B team of national political leadership and Congress approves the sale later this summer, towards the end of the summer of 1787. Now, the Ohio Company would want you to buy their argument, you know, that they were really proposing just an extension of previous congressional land policy, slow, cautious, and orderly. That's certainly what they told Congress. That's what most of the scholarship says today. That's kind of the magic of Cutler's argument, is that it's still shaping perceptions. But in fact, the Ohio Company sale let speculators or would-be speculators across the early Republic know that Congress was kind of open for business. And indeed, Congress became positively addicted to these large-scale land sales. Between 1787 and 1788, they authorized private contracts for millions of acres of speculators, millions of acres to speculators, pardon me, and not at all in a gradual seeding kind of way. So here are two bits from a map of the American West that was drawn in 1778. And the owner of this map sketched in these land sales that Congress made as they happened over time. So this portion here on the bottom left is at the confluence of the Ohio and the Mississippi rivers, and you can see that there's four big tracts there that Congress has sold. On the upper right, there's that kind of scraggly-looking purchase, which was made by John Cleve Sims, a New Jersey congressman, and then the big pink one furthest on the right is the Ohio Company sale itself. And you'll see there that the sale is depicted not as the Ohio Company and the Scioto Company, but as just one big thing. You know, so basically what I'm trying to say is that the Ohio Company and more riskier, adventurous types of land speculation were born as kind of conjoined twins. So that's the second way. With a good and timely argument aimed at a national state that's still grappling with the challenges of revolutionary change, speculators shifted congressional land policy and opened the land mania floodgates. So now to Maine for, very quickly, the third way that you wrest huge tracts of land from a fledgling new government. And predictably enough, that way is power politics and corruption, kind of plain and simple. This map shows, this is Maine, by the way, although you wouldn't be blamed for not being able to pick it out. This map shows the lands that Henry Knox and William Dewar bought from Massachusetts in the early 1790s. It's 3 million acres. And to do that, they had to get around a state lands committee. And this committee was ideologically opposed to land speculation. But it was also kind of so institutionally lame and non-functional that it wasn't bringing any money into the state coffers. So Knox and Dewar decided that they needed to go over this committee's heads and straight to the legislature. And to do that, they started bribing members of the legislature. They offered key members shares of the land purchase. They extended offers for government and military appointments that Knox, as Secretary of War, was in a position to bestow, things like officers' commissions, postmaster general, the military's top doctor. It's hard to see this because Knox and Dewar's agents were very careful to not make the connection. In fact, they confined talk of these two things to separate letters. But when you line up the correspondence, it's very clear that this is what they're doing. And it worked. Within a year, they had bought 3 million acres, enough to really control land prices in Maine. They basically established a monopoly. And in doing so, they made the Lands Committee, the state institution, redundant. So the committee was abolished 2 years later. Basically, what had happened there was that Knox and Dewar had succeeded in substituting a part of the state, a public entity, out and putting in place their own private enterprise. So that's the third way you get land from governments. Now, you're probably wondering where George Washington fits into this whole story. And this summer, I have learned that he's actually quite an exception to it. Washington, as we all know, was a large-scale land speculator. In fact, although I don't fully buy it, some historians frame land speculation as one of the major reasons he decided to buy into American independence in the first place. And most of Washington's speculative lands lay in what is today West Virginia. So this is a map from the papers of George Washington. He got the vast majority of them not during the period I study, the 1780s and 90s, but earlier, in the 1760s and especially the 1770s. And some of these lands were payment for Washington's service as a British officer during the Seven Years' War. Others were tracts that he had bought from other officers who had been paid in lands. And he did buy a lot of them. By the 1780s, Washington owned about 52,000 acres in different parts of the West, and the vast majority of them were here along the Ohio River Valley. Here are two of Washington's own maps of these lands. He doesn't own all the tracts that are depicted here, but a substantial number of them. I think that these two maps, which depict lands on the Ohio River and the, I think it's the Great Kanawha River, though. Yes, it's the Great Kanawha River. Combined, depict about 20-ish thousand acres of his land holdings. So a lot of land. But that said, after the Revolution, when most of the American elite is diving headfirst into the land business, Washington's actually trying to get out of it. And I think that the story of land mania can help to explain why. Washington's enthusiasm for westward expansion never waned. He was a virtual fanatic when it came to plans for a canal that would link east and west and consolidate sort of the bonds of the American Union across the Appalachian Mountains. But that said, beginning in 1791, he started trying and repeating repeatedly failing to sell his own lands to other speculators. Among the reasons why are that he was strapped for cash. As I learned from fellow Bruce Ragsdale earlier this summer, he was trying to channel resources into Mount Vernon, which he hoped to make kind of a model farm for how to practice enlightened agriculture, and kind of it would serve as a sort of beacon of enlightened agricultural practices for the whole nation. And as I learned from Mary Thompson, who's the research historian here, Washington might also have been trying to gather the money to emancipate his and his wife's slaves. But I'd add a third part of the story, a third part of the explanation for why he's trying to get out of the land business, and that is that this land mania in the 1780s and 90s really changed the meaning of land ownership. Washington never owned land on the scale of millions or hundreds of thousands of acres. You know, he dealt more in thousands and tens of thousands. And the land maniacs whose speculations dwarfed his really treated land like a commodity, something to be quickly bought and sold, and something that you would make money really not on its inherent qualities, but more on the fluctuations in price, the way that the market determines how much lands are worth. Washington did not really approve of that, and he especially didn't approve of the methods that people had for getting lands, you know, exploiting political flux and the chaos in the West. He called those people land jobbers and land speculators. That's who he reserved that type of language for. Instead, Washington is interested in an orderly settlement of the West, kind of what the Ohio Company was saying it was going to do. And in fact, he hearkened back really to a much older idea of land ownership, an idea that became archaic precisely because of land mania. This is the idea of land not as a commodity, but more something along the lines of a feudal manor, you know, the manorial idea with a benevolent lord kind of overseeing what happens on it. For much of his time as a landowner, in fact, Washington was not trying to sell his land, he was trying to lease it to tenants. And that's a really key distinction. That said, in an era of cheap land, it was very hard to get tenants and keep them paying their rent on your property. So I think that all of this put together, the way land mania had changed what it meant to own land, is a really key part of why Washington decided to try and get out of the business. So back to land mania writ large. Why would anybody but me care about this story to tie everything together? Well, let me use two juicy quotations to kind of summarize where we've been and to finish up. The first is from a guy named Peregrine Foster, which is just a name that I love. And Peregrine was a minor and mostly failed land speculator in the Ohio River Valley. He came from a successful family. He had two brothers in Congress, one in the House and one in the Senate. But he himself flunked out of Brown and then went west to try and make a name for himself out there. So this quotation comes from a letter he wrote to one of his brothers. And Foster said, "It is delightful," speaking of the Ohio River Valley, he said, "it is delightful to behold a country in its infancy. Abundant is the reward. If a philosopher, here is his place for contemplation. If delighted with ruminating on the works of his creator, here is his best plan. If fond of ease, if sloth has weakened his bodily and mental faculties, here is the place to obtain with little fatigue the renaissance of life, and in indolence, like the possum, to linger out a useless existence." He's getting very philosophical here. "If delighted with improvement, if fond of the enjoyment of the good things of this life, here he is most amply paid for any exertion to acquire them. Perhaps, my dear brother, you will think I have too high an opinion of Ohio's banks, but I wish you were now seated with me viewing yonder bottom of 13,000 acres. You would join in saying, how delightful the prospect." So here's Foster looking at this expanse of land, thinking about it as a commodity, and infusing it with real political content. You know, Foster is saying that this is a place where any white man can be independent and self-determining, even if he is lazy as a possum. This is land so good that it can support an unindustrious Republican citizenry. That, to me, is a fascinating hint at why the early Republic land market was as insane as it was. Peregrine knew that there were fortunes to be made in selling exactly this opportunity, literally the land that lay beneath American political philosophy to people. So that's why in almost every letter he writes to his brothers how he wished to vest every halfpenny or every farthing I own or the shirt off my back, that's an actual quotation, in Western lands. Next quotation comes from a totally different person, Robert Morris, financier of the American Revolution and one of the nation's most audacious land speculators. And this is from a kind of book that Morris published about his biggest land company called the North American Land Company. Uncultivated lands, Morris said, within the United States have been an object of attention from the first settlement of the country to the present day. At one period or another, and especially since the war, the several states have perhaps prematurely and with a blamable haste drawn their revenues from or liquidated their debts by the resale of them on very low terms to such as could advance money to pay for them. Should sound familiar by now. Nothing is now left but the sum in the public hands, he means. Nothing is now left but the summits of mountains, abrupt precipices, or plains covered with stones. Lands in general must now increase in value with the population. For the states having generally disposed of their vacant lands, the settlers will have no other resort but to private proprietors or companies, people like Morris himself. This is a slick, even kind of cynical bit of rhetoric because Morris had bought up more of that land than just about anybody in the country. So I don't know where the talk of blamable haste comes from. For the past century or so, historians have debated whether the American Revolution expanded political and economic opportunity or consolidated elite power. This has been a real kind of historiographical battle royale. And I think that the story of land mania demonstrates that those competing interpretations are actually two sides of the same coin. I think these quotations sort of nicely capture that. Revolutionary political change and the challenges of building independent governments gave speculators the opportunities and the tools that they needed to achieve the outcome that Morris described, where they controlled the land market, you know, to get their hands on the land. And they did so with such alacrity because it seemed like a sure bet, a once in a millennium investment opportunity to be able to finance the expansion of what they believed was an exceptional empire of liberty, you know, to sell the promise of Peregrine Foster's vision, the life of a yeoman possum citizen, to an imminently exploding number of Americans. So basically, I want to end by saying that speculators sought to profit off revolution by selling yeoman republicanism. And I'll end there, and I'm happy to take questions. Yes. Yes, I like that. That is a way of framing what speculators are doing, buying up the right to evict people. Squatters were a big challenge. That's part of the reason why Washington had so much trouble with his own western lands, because either if he got a tenant on there, squatters would leave, or people would leave and become squatters on somebody else's lands, or people would squat on Washington's lands and not pay them rent. There were a lot of challenges and a lot of lawsuits and legal kerfuffles, lots of intimidation that speculators kind of tried to put into play. But they could also adopt a more kind of symbiotic approach. So this is something that a lot of speculators will do, is to send an agent out to the lands they have just bought to figure out who's on it, to identify the squatters. And then they'll offer those squatters a little bit of either very cheap or free land. In other words, turning squatters into either tenants or, more usually, independent landowners. And the reason that that speculators were interested in doing that was because having people on your land made the lands more valuable. So you get a couple settlers on there, and if they're squatters, whatever, suddenly the rest of the lands that you still have to sell can be sold at a much higher price. So I think the smart speculators took the latter approach. The ones who kept on trying to evict squatters again and again were just sort of running up against a brick wall, and it was a persistent problem throughout the period. Yes. Oh, pardon me.
Yes. Was a system of land liquidation established somewhere so someone could go to an office and determine who owns what, doing a title search for example?
That's a mess in this period. By the way, the question, in case to reiterate, was there a system of recording titles of land ownership? There were many systems, and they generated a lot of confusion, and that confusion left a lot of room for speculators and squatters, actually, to try and work their way into getting land. So in Virginia, for instance, Virginia sets up a really intricate system of, okay, you got people in the East who want to buy lands in Kentucky, and what they got to do is like send somebody out there to choose the lands while they stay behind and pay some money into the land office in Richmond, but then the exact tract of the land is going to be recorded in a county surveyor's office in Kentucky, and eventually the county surveyor has to send information back to Richmond. It's just a total disaster. And that, it's exactly that system that created the famed mess of land ownership in Kentucky in the 1780s and 90s. I don't know if any of you have seen these maps of what titles looked like in Kentucky, but it looks like 52-card pickup. Like, you just have surveys overlapping each other all over the place because the process was so decentralized. After the period I study, once the federal government is really the only government that's selling lands, then there's a bit of a drive more towards land offices that, you know, through which all of the land purchases are going to be channeled. There's still plenty of problems, but it does become a bit more centralized once governments kind of figure out what they're doing. Yes, in the back.
You mentioned the deals that were being made, or at least the relations with the Native American communities in, say, Western Pennsylvania. But Washington hasn't been very familiar with that, obviously, from the French and Indian War days. And I would want to know, because I'm not an expert, I don't know anything about the progress of his moral consideration of their land rights, as it were. Did he change over the course of his life and then become someone who extolled the virtues of giving the Native Americans some rights in this respect? Or do you see a pattern there in his life, starting with the French and Indian War, that changed over time?
That's an excellent question. And I am, unfortunately, not familiar enough with how Washington's ideas themselves changed over time. The broader sweep of change in for the early republic as a whole kind of fluctuated in and out of taking native land claims very seriously and trying to adopt an amicable approach to Native Americans versus a really antagonistic approach, and there's kind of a cycle that shifts back and forth almost every 5 or 6 years. During the 1780s and 90s. So there's a period, especially when the U.S. is pretty weak, where they're trying to deal on a somewhat straightforward footing with Native Americans in the 1780s. And then that doesn't seem to be working out how Americans had intended. And so things get a little bit worse. And then eventually you have kind of open warfare in the West in the early part of the 1790s, and that ends in 1785. And then there's, you know, now that these Native nations have been defeated, there's an attempt to say, like, okay, well, now we can assimilate them and kind of turn them into the yeoman farmers that we want to put out on these lands. So there's a real cycle throughout the period. Yes. People definitely got rich. The people who invested in the 1780s and 90s, however, were typically not among them. The trick here is that, on the whole, kind of systemically, this period creates great opportunities for land speculation. And that's why speculators invest so deeply. But they go overboard, and they begin leveraging their purchases one on another. They end up kind of getting these really knotty systems of credit that they build, and eventually some payment will come due and they won't be able to meet it because they have not yet been able to sell the land that they bought before. So then the whole kind of system implodes, and that's how we get these individual speculators ending up in debtor's prison. There were kind of two paths to actually making money off of land. And one was to not go overboard and to not buy too much land and think that you're going to make money off of it too quickly. This is, in other words, one of the paths to profit is development. Put yourself on the lands oversee the settlement, sell directly retail to individual farmers, and don't try and get ahead of yourself. And in that case, some people do make a pretty penny. The other path to profit is kind of the opposite, actually, and that's to buy up a huge tract and sell it very quickly to some Europeans with money. So that's what Robert Morris does with after Phelps, the guy who I started with, failed in that Western New York purchase. Robert Morris bought up most of that land, and he was able to sell it to Europeans in two parts. One bit to a group of British investors called the Pulteney Association, and the other group to a bunch of Dutch investors called the Holland Land Company. And this happened very quickly, and he did make a very good amount of money off of it. And the example kind of lit up the minds of American land speculators, like, oh my God, look what Robert Morris did. We all have to get on and start doing this. Robert Morris himself tried to replicate that success, but almost everybody failed because during the 1780s and 90s, Europeans came to realize that it was going to take a lot of time to make money off of American land. So they started getting very dubious about investing. When Robert Morris is kind of ailing, he writes a little memo about the lands he had owned and the lands he still owns. And one of the things he says is like, oh, if I had just stopped after that first Western New York thing, I would have been the richest man in the country. He writes that memo from within the walls of the Prune Street Jail in Philadelphia, or the Walnut Street Jail. Yes.
Obviously, there were people who were speculating in the financing of the speculators. How did they do it? Who were they?
A lot of them were the same people. They fared pretty poorly because they were. So one of the things that happens is these intricate webs of credit that I was talking about a minute ago generate their own little pieces of paper to represent what's going on there. So to go back to Robert Morris, he and his partners in their speculations in Washington, D.C., issued a bunch of promissory notes that were called Morris and Nicholson notes. And they were basically IOUs they'd give to people to try and get more money into their schemes. And like the government's debt certificates, those things depreciated wildly. So they became absolutely an object of speculation. People would buy them up, thousands of them, for like 2 pennies on the dollar, okay? Kind of betting that eventually Morris and Nicholson are going to make a lot of money, and once they make a lot of money, they'll be able to pay their IOUs, and then this IOU will be worth a lot of money. Didn't work. Massive failure. That was, in fact, I think the single greatest cause of that 1797 credit crunch during which Abraham Morehouse wrote that letter that I used to talk about those three ideas. One more question. Yes, please.
Good job, Michael.
Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder where the other military tract is. Yes, those are, right next to it. That's right, above the Ohio Company and Scioto Company purchases. Yes, absolutely. Those are the tracts that governments were issuing these certificates about. They're kind of the Virginia and the one on top of the Ohio Company purchase is the congressional counterpart to those tracts in western Pennsylvania that Pennsylvania was using to give lands to its own soldiers and officers. So they these are two other kind of buffer colonies that have been planned there. Yes. Thank you all so much for coming.
All right. Well, I think you all can see why it's such a stimulating place to work around here when you got young, brilliant minds like this going to be shaping the field going forward. This is very exciting. What a great presentation that was. I think it touches on a lot of the challenges of the founding period. Now, the next lunch and fellowship, I believe, is going to be Dana Stefanelli, Stephen, in the next month. And Dana is actually looking at the development of Washington, D.C., which Ken Bowling, who's right over here, knows quite a bit about, has written a great book about that. So we're going to kind of extend this speculation nation for another month. But before we do that, I just wanted to say thank you personally to Michael, and on the behalf of the Library of the Mount Vernon Ladies Association, we're going to present him with one of these very hard-to-get portraits of George Washington with a representation. Michael Blakeman, Fred W. Smith National Library for the Study of George Washington, Fellow 2014-15. So thank you, Michael, and best wishes. Godspeed.
Yeah. Let me just say a quick word of thanks to Doug and to Stephen and Michael and Mary and Sarah at the library, everybody who works here. Historians' work can be pretty isolating, pretty painstaking, and it has been such a treat to be able to be here and become part of a really budding intellectual community. It's been the most productive summer of my life by far, and I've had a great time, and I'm so thankful to Doug and everybody else here.
We hope you enjoyed this week's discussion. The Washington Library looks forward to continuing these conversations about our early American history. Please visit mountvernon.org/library to learn more about the library's resources and programs. And remember, Mount Vernon is open 365 days a year and looks forward to welcoming you. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.